KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and we are broadcasting live from the San Francisco Main Library as part of the Night of Ideas. The theme of the night is the future city, and one thing is certain, the future of the city looks hotter. With climate change comes rising seas, flooding, and threats to infrastructure, and those effects may be felt most acutely in cities. In this hour, we're going to be joined by a futurist, an architect, a science fiction writer, and a landscape designer, and we're going to look at some bold actions cities can take and ask, how can we design cities for a changing climate? That's all next, after the news. And we welcome you to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are broadcasting live this evening from the Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Main Library. As you can hear, we have a live audience, and we are delighted to say that the live audience is here and will be participating in this evening's broadcast. They're also standing here, and they're standing room only because every seat is filled, and we're going to talk about a pretty serious subject in this hour, climate change. Reports are pouring in about the impacts of climate change coming sooner than we had expected. It raises questions. What will our cities look like in a changed climate, perhaps being the biggest question of all, and will our shores be protected from rising seas? Will climate refugees overrun city services? Will we have made it to a carbon-free existence? Joining us to tackle these questions and how we can talk about, as well, designing cities for a changing climate are Alex Steffen. He's immediately on my left. He's a planetary futurist, author of the forthcoming book, The Snap Forward, The End of Predatory Delay and the Beginning of Climate Action. Welcome to the program. Good to
Thank
have you.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Glad to have you, Alex. And we also have Liz Ogbu here, who's on my right. And Liz is a designer, an urbanist, a social innovator, founder, and principal of Studio O. Welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. We also want to welcome Richard Kennedy. He's a landscape architect, senior principal in James Corner Field Operations, which designed the High Line in New York and the Presidio Tunnel tops in San Francisco. Good to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And we also want to welcome Annalee Newitz, and she is a science journalist, science fiction writer, author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Good to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. We're glad that you were going to give us some wisdom on that one, particularly as in your title. Let me begin, if I may, with you, Alex. And let's begin. Alex also has, as I said, a forthcoming book, and it's all about the real question of how climate change interfaces with the city, or how the interface actually occurs between the city and climate change. And we had this intergovernmental panel, as many of you know, on climate change. It was not necessarily good or heartening news. I should say that I get a postcard from an anonymous listener frequently who says, we're on life support here and we really need to talk about it. So we're going to talk about it with you. I think the essence of what you have to tell us is we have to act, and we have to act as rapidly and with as much alacrity as we possibly can.
That's the gist of it. Yeah. We are in a planetary crisis, and the choices we make in just the next few years will have profound implications for centuries, in fact, millennia. And one of the difficult things to really grasp about this planetary crisis is that it's a discontinuity. What we're used to thinking is normal, how we're used to thinking the world works, the speed of change that we tend to think is reasonable, all these things are just right out the window. And we're now in a different world where change is fast, experience is no guide to wisdom. And the impacts are very serious, and the stakes are high.
The only predictable thing may be the unpredictability itself, I think you've said.
Yeah. Exactly.
So how do we speed up, and where's the triage in terms of what we speed up? Where do we put the emphasis?
Well, first of all, we have to acknowledge that we here in places like the Bay Area have a lot of capacity to change. There are a lot of people elsewhere who are neither causing anything like as big a part of the problem, nor do they have the capacity to lead in terms of just realities of wealth. And what we can do here is start to think very seriously about how we take not marginal steps, not incremental steps, but how we make big leaps towards carbon zero living, how we decarbonize our transportation system, how we change the way we eat, how we build cities so that they allow us to live without cars, do infill, do green building, build more transit. Now, we've been talking about these things here for a very long time.
And we've been moving forward in California in ways that almost nobody else has in the United States.
It's true. And we're still not moving anywhere near fast enough. And that should be the really scary thing. We are the leaders in this country, and we're not moving anywhere near fast enough.
So how to move faster? I get back to that question. And where to move faster, particularly? I mean, is there something that really, in your judgment, is right at the top of the priority list?
Build. That is at the top of the list. We have a massive housing crisis here in this state. In almost every city, and we know that adding dense, affordable, green housing to cities is possible, and if we do it right, we can decrease auto dependence, we can drop emissions, and we can have the money to build the kinds of systems we're going to need to not only bring our CO2 down with clean energy and stuff like that, but also prepare for the very serious consequences that are already hitting our shores.
And again, Alex Steffen is a planetary futurist and author of Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Can Save the Planet. Let me go to you, Liz Ogbu. Liz Ogbu is a designer and urbanist and social innovator and founder and principal of Studio O. And you're talking about a radical restructuring, too. You're talking about it in terms of design, for one thing, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think Alex is right in many ways that from an architecture perspective, we actually have the capacity to build better, right? We have made lots of advances in technology. Our buildings have possibilities of being carbon neutral. The buildings that we design today make a much lighter footprint on the earth than we did many, many years ago. We can talk about how here living in Silicon Valley, what it might look like to have a city without cars. Like that is all within our grasp. I think the challenge, however, is that it is not just a technology problem, right? It's also a people problem. Some of what Alex was talking about in terms of the fact that we've continued to stay in this loop and things haven't been getting significantly better has nothing to do with the technology that exists. It has everything to do with the sacrifices that we are willing to make. And so as an architect, I can tell you the things to design to make that better city, but the other piece of what is the thing that keeps people poor, what are the things that keep us leading wasteful existence, that still remains. And so I think some of the question is, are we at the point where we're ready to make those big sacrifices?
What would the sacrifices entail? What would the sacrifices entail, particularly where the impoverished are concerned, or the homeless, or people who really can't survive in the cities without living out in the streets?
So I think the idea is that for us to live the life that we're leading right now, those of us with privilege are causing harm for those who have without. And so I think some of the questions have to be, what are we willing to give up? What are we willing to spend more on? Whether it is in terms of taxes or is in terms of us completely reconfiguring the ways in which we design our cities. Like maybe we're not having such huge sprawl. Maybe our cities need to be much more compact. We have to be willing to let go of having such a large footprint.
Well, you do a whole number on a vision of what we might like, this is very optimistic, look like 200 years from now. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is also goes back to the whole thing of, you know, what it's the question we're asking. So if it is just about the architecture, the city of 200 years from now could look like a place with lots of towers. We could have lots of green life all around. I'm sure Richard will talk a little bit more about that. We could have no cars on the street.
See the Jetson-type transit?
The Jetsons, yeah. We could get to the Jetsons very easily. But again, the question is, who gets to benefit from that? And the way that we're going, those who have already benefited from the system the way it is now will probably be the ones who continue to benefit, and the poor will continue to remain poor, those who are marginalized. So unless we do something about changing our social systems, I think the city of the future may have Jetsons-like scenery, but you're probably still going to have some homeless people on the street.
So what makes you optimistic? Because, you, like I said, you're talking about 200 years from now. That's pretty sanguine.
Well, you know, I like there's a Desmond Tutu quote that says, I'm not an optimist, I'm a prisoner of hope. Which I think is very appropriate for our times right now. And what makes me optimistic is that we're starting to ask these questions. I think we're starting to, on a larger scale, be confronted with the challenge that is happening, and a lot more people are starting to ask, how do I do this different? And I think the reports that you talked about are really helpful in that, because they're sort of pointing to this mitigation strategy that we've been having is not working. And so unless we start to do something radical, we actually aren't going to get to that better place. We may not actually even be around.
Well, let me go to Richard here, because Richard Kennedy's been involved in doing some things that are very different. I mean, let's. I mean, I said you led the design on Well, you led a contest design, actually, one of nine teams. Let's talk about that, because it has to do with the South Bay, and it has to do with a project that I think will be very interesting to people who are here.
Absolutely. Well, I'll first start by saying that I am absolutely an optimist in the pressures and challenges ahead. And I also believe in cities. I do think cities are where the action is, but they are also the most sustainable way of living. They're compact and dense and tied to transit. But cities can be better. They can be healthier. They can be greener. They can be more equitable. They can be more open to adjustment by more people. And so we entered this challenge that was that happened across the Bay Area that looked at sea level rise as it relates to the entire Bay. There's nearly 500 miles of edge and hundreds of communities around the Bay that are vulnerable to sea level rise. And that was the starting point, what to do, how to start, where to start. And so no clients, no project, no specific site. It's kind of a completely open brief. And very quickly, we made a decision to take an optimistic tone, that we are in a renaissance of transforming cities, making them greener and healthier. Let's start there and spread that message. We also understood that we had to do a lot of communicating and educating and informing folks of what's happening and how quickly it is happening. And so we took what is a very complicated issue. Climate change, waters are rising, it's happening over decades, it's not immediately apparent to everyone, and we made it as simple as possible. And we called our work The Sponge. And the idea is that nature, in the form of creeks, wetlands, marshes, tidal basins and tidal mudflats, wet-footed forests, actually can absorb and hold water during high tides and high seas and flood events from the hills. And we need to give more space to that kind of action and create more space for nature.
You're talking about a green infrastructure, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely, but on a very big scale and carving territory for that. And so it was kind of a way of making it colloquial and fun, and we called it the South Bay Sponge, the idea that it's completely understandable, recognizable, and immediate. And what made it all the more, I would say, populist is we took our message on the road and we got an Airstream trailer and wrapped it as an iridescent green sponge. So it kind of it looked like a SpongeBob. And that was part of it too. We wanted to be the most famous sponge in California, as famous as SpongeBob. And we just took this iridescent, almost glowingly bright sponge and drove it all around the Bay and stopped at farmers markets, schools, churches, wherever there was an audience. And we just started talking about the issue. And so many people, people also came because we were giving out cotton candy. It was it was a bit odd to be giving out cotton candy at farmers markets, but it brought people in. And it was disarming. And because it was just strange enough, it was just unusual enough, it was green, it was glowing, it was out of nowhere, it disarmed everyone. And they became more curious and more open to talk about the issues. And of course, it's scary, it's frightening, it is happening. Many people we talked about do also already see flooding. But it became a creative conversation. They thought more positively about what they could and what they might do to be a part of the solution. And so it was just a beginning, and it was only a few months of this kind of engagement, but it did make me convinced that an optimistic message does play a part in this, and so does creativity and design.
So you're talking really about green buffers to the city. Tell us how this would work in a single site, though, and can that be just a microcosm? Can that be expanded, in other words, in a broad way?
Well, as I said, I do love cities, and I do love density. I love being with other people, and I do think we all, in some sense, like being surrounded by people, being cheek to jowl with others. We go to popular restaurants, and we come to events like this, filled with people. And so the solution is to actually make development, these housing projects and new development, more compact, tighter, more dense, and create more space that can be retained as nature, as green space, green territory. Parks, trails, running spaces, healthy producing environments, playgrounds and other things. That when the tides come in, they get flooded. When storms come from the hills and rainwater's coming from the hills, they get flooded. But then those tides recede, the storms calm down, and they dry up. So it's just more dense, more compact, but at the same time, more green, and I think more vibrant.
I like your optimism, but at the same time, what's buzzing around in my head are all these refugees that we're going to have to be concerned about and rising population numbers. Thoughts on that?
Well, density too is part of it. Is
more density, you know,
more density.
Yeah.
But it's doing it in a way where you're identifying where there's space for green resources and where there's space for development. And I think to Alex's point, I think we do need to build. We do need to be creating those spaces where cities can grow and populations can live.
And Annalise, if I can go to you now. You're good on the refugee question, I think. Give us at least a sense of your wisdom as you see things projected into the future as much as you can.
Well, I mean, I think borders are the enemy of survival. And I mean that in many different ways. But I think that we are looking toward a future where there is going to be mass migration due to climate change, due to political instability. And we're going to have to be thinking about not just the questions around, you know, developing more places for them to live, which I think absolutely we do, but I want to return to what Liz was saying about the fact that, you know, we also need to rebuild our way of dealing with people who are vulnerable in our populations and dealing with poverty, dealing with healthcare issues for those people, dealing with education for those people. And I think that's part of reimagining the city, is that we, as we're reimagining it, we're thinking about, how do we build a sustainable infrastructure? How do we scale it up? How do we make sure that people have access to power? But we also need to be thinking about how do we rebuild all of our social services, and how do we make a city that's welcoming and that isn't built inside borders and that actually has open borders. And I think the more that we can abolish borders, the closer we get to having healthy cities.
Well, you've been looking at some cities that turned out not so healthy. You're going back about 9,000 years, and I think your book that's imminent, and we're talking about Pompeii and cities that have been destroyed. Now, what have we learned from the past, or what have you learned from the past that could apply really to the serious trouble we're in now with climate change?
So after I finished my book about mass extinction, I decided to turn to a lighter topic, which was ancient abandoned cities. And so for the past several years... for the past several years, I've been visiting archaeological sites and talking with folks who work on ancient urban sites where people left. And I looked at four cities in particular. Pompeii was one of them. And you think you know why people left Pompeii, but actually it's more complicated than that. But what really united all of these cities, one which is, as you said, about 9,000 years old, is that people would start to leave those cities, abandon city life, you know, often at great expense and personal cost, when there were environmental problems and infrastructure problems combined with political problems. And that's pretty much the recipe for wrecking a city, is if you combine those two things. A lot of cities survive massive environmental problems, infrastructure that's crumbling, if they have a healthy political or community structure. And the same goes for, you know, a lot of cities have survived, like, for example, Rome has survived, you know, let's call it thousands of years of political instability, but they have managed to maintain a healthy infrastructure through that time, or physical infrastructure. So really what I found was that, you know, climate change and infrastructure maintenance are a huge theme throughout the history of cities. And you never, when you see people abandoning a city like, say, Pompeii, which, as you probably remember, was buried under tons of ash after Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 CE, people weren't just leaving it because they were scared and they had superstitions. It was an economic choice. It wasn't just about an environmental problem. It was that, you know, Rome wasn't willing to pay to keep maintaining a city that was now buried. Even though they certainly had the money to unbury it, they just weren't going to put the resources into it. So I think what history shows us is that as we look to the future, we constantly have to weigh both the kind of nuts and bolts of environmental sustainability with the kind of more heady work of thinking through our political system and thinking through how we handle the most vulnerable people in our societies.
Well, you've hit on two of the most important points, sustainability and also really preparation, as well as what we're talking about with change. But let's go back to building. I mean, there's a lot of talk now about futuristic building materials that could be sustained or sustained to a greater degree, particularly with what we're faced with climate change. What about solutions? I mean, what do you see? What are they talking? What are designers talking about now?
Well, certainly, I mean, there's a number of different solutions, some of which we've already talked about here tonight. And then if you want to get more futuristic and you want to kind of go into a science fictional mode, and I write science fiction, so I do occasionally indulge that. You know, a lot of designers now are thinking about incorporating biological materials into city design. There's a really interesting group in New York called The Living, and they are working on the idea of, you know, the notion that maybe one day you would plant a seed and grow a house. And that's a kind of extreme version of what they're working on. But the idea would be that you might be able to build with living materials, with semi-permeable membranes, self-healing materials so that you wouldn't have to just rip down your house and build a new one. It could heal itself. It could work with the environment instead of against the environment. And I think that that stuff is quite exciting. I love the idea of a city which itself is alive, and also a city that maybe is built to contain not just humans, but also animals, non-human animals, I should say, because we're animals. I know it's easy to forget, but we actually are. And so we do live with animals all the time, but we don't build our cities in harmony with them. And I love the notion of a city that might build you know, a migration pathway for animals to pass through, because this is a huge issue in cities often, that we kind of wreck natural habitats and the natural pathways of the other animals that want to get through. So, you know, I don't think we're going to be, I would love for us to be in Wakanda one day. You know, I think that that's a beautiful ideal for a city in terms of design, where it's partially natural and it's partially built, and, you know, we're kind of living in connection with nature.
Can we stay with the futuristic for just a moment? You see moving cities, floating cities, any of those kinds of things?
I mean, you know, a floating city, where are you going to get the energy for that? That's what I always ask. Like, it sounds really great, right? And a moving city sounds really awesome, too. But I think in terms of what's sustainable, you know, what we're really thinking about is high-density cities with, you know, the movability part being things like having really great public transit that can kind of respond to changing circumstances. And so, you know, instead of having a train that always has to follow the same track, having some kind of transit system that can shift with the movements of the people and with the migrations of people.
And how about if we just do more urban farming, or maybe here in San Francisco invest in a pumping system?
Yeah, a pumping system. That'd be great. Yeah, and I think that that's part of what's interesting about some of the work that Richard is doing is, you know, building with the idea of climate change coming, with the idea that the water level will rise. And it's something that San Francisco and other coastal cities are going to have to think about, is that everything we build now has to be robust against water level rising.
Sea level is rising, and it's probably rising to some degree, unfortunately, while we're speaking. Here we go back to Alex's initial pointer. We got to move fast and got to move quickly and move with not even hesitation on all this. We're going to talk more about it. We're also going to get you involved if you have questions or comments. In about a few minutes after we return, we will go to them. We're talking, if you've just joined us, at the Night of Ideas, a future of cities in a changing climate. You're listening to the Forum Program on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum live from the library here in San Francisco, the public library. We have a live audience, in fact, with us. And we also have a splendid panel, Alex Steffen with us, planetary futurist and author of the forthcoming book, The Snap Forward, The End of Predatory Delay and the Beginning of Climate Action. Liz Agbu, who's a designer and urbanist and social innovator and founder of founder and principal of Studio O. Richard Kennedy, landscape architect and senior principal with the James Corner Field Operations, which designed the High Line in New York and the Presidio Tunnel Tops in San Francisco. And Annalee Newitz, who is a science journalist and science fiction writer and author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. We're going to go to the audience in a short few moments here. In fact, if you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll try to get to you with a microphone soon. But I want to go back to Alex and talk about really what you brought up before, which is how much human interaction is a part of this, how important it is, and political will, of course, and governance, but all that. But let's go back to something that we heard from Annalise about just the connection between what we're doing now and the future.
Yeah, so one of the craziest things about this planetary crisis that we have is that the farther ahead you want to plan, the more immediate your action is. So if we want to think about 200 years from now, the things that we need to do to make 200 years from now livable are immediate term actions, which is this really weird space that we're in, where, you know, generally in the past, if you wanted to think long term, you thought long term. Now, if you want to think long term, you get busy. You go out there and start doing things. And so much of the political fight around this is not really whether or not we will end up doing something, it's how fast. And so those who are making a lot of money on the current system naturally counsel slowness. You know, I call that predatory delay. But there are a lot of people now who are recognizing that by acting much more quickly than we're comfortable with, we open up huge opportunities for the future.
I'm going to raise an elephant in the room, and I don't mean to think of the elephant as a GOP here, but it absolutely seems necessary. and that has to do with, and any one of you can take this, what we do in the present political climate. Where we find the political will? I mean, we live in an extraordinary city with, I mean, the whole Bay Area is kind of a cocoon. We're still dependent in many ways on federal help, though. And so some thoughts, just some random thoughts that come to your mind, the four of your consciousness.
Deal.
We need a Green Deal, a new
Green
deal?
Green New Deal,
yeah,
yes.
Okay. Anybody else on that?
Liz? I would also add that, you know, it's been very interesting since this current administration came into power how all of a sudden you saw action happening at the city and at the state level, and that people stopped expecting the federal government to do stuff for us. And we started to invest more in our local systems and talk about how we can make change at that level. And so I think we need to double down on that. But I think it's not just about having those local actors sort of, you know, come out with new policies and rules. I think it's also about how locally do we fix some of the harm that is in existence. And actually, in some ways, if you try to think about all of this stuff at the federal level, it's almost too overwhelming, right? Like, we just stop because it's like, there's nothing we can do about that. Whereas at the local level, we actually do have the capacity to start to make change. And so if we start to talk about not just what are we passing in terms of that, but what are we doing to actually heal the social structures at the local level, that we actually might have a chance of eventually making our way up to completely redoing the
federal system. And denying the denial that's coming from the federal level.
Exactly. We don't need them. Really. I mean, we do, but we don't. Like, actually, if we're talking about how do we reinvest in people power, that is happening at the local level. What the federal government is this sort of amorphous system that we really can't put our finger on. But at the local level, you can. And so I think, you know, the level of your neighbor, it is possible to make change. And so why don't we start reinvesting in that?
Let me just use a good example here, if I may, because I think I want to go to you on this, Richard. You talk about geoengineering is a possible way of moving forward in terms of keeping San Francisco from flooding. And you say it can be done. It's viable, but we're not doing it. So how do we get off our haunches and do it?
Well, I want to agree with Liz. I think it's by assembling people at a local level. We saw that whole effort, and again, it was only a few months, but the notion of the sponge was about building a very simple idea into a bigger campaign to ultimately assemble millions of voters, effectively, because that's how it's going to have to happen. We're to get money from the state, and you know, but even you know, to get money from the federal level, we have to be a much bigger and more informed and more consolidated voting bloc. And the idea was to try to make a message that was compelling enough to multiply, because the innovations, the technologies, the design, the engineering capacity is already in place. We know how to do it. We just need the funding and political will.
Yeah. Annalise, you were going to add something here?
Yeah, I was going to say one of the things that I think has been really instructive over the past couple of years is seeing how much the pushback against you know, building for sustainability and even acknowledging the reality of climate change is also tied into social issues like racism, which has become such a huge political issue at the national level over the past couple of years, as I think some people are kind of waking up to how important racism has been to shaping how we've built the country. Other people are saying, yeah, we knew that 100 years ago. Thanks for noticing, white people. But yay, you know, that's good. And I think that that's why we're seeing more discussion now about issues like environmental racism, and we're seeing that discussed much more openly at the community level. And much more openly in the environmental movement, which hasn't always been open to that interpretation of how we're handling sustainability in communities. And I think that, again, this goes back to the issue around local politics, because the more that we are working at the local level, the more we become aware of how one group of people in a city might be leading a great sustainable life and might be living in areas where their homes are going to be, you know, free of flooding, while other groups in the city are, you know, left in areas where there's toxic cleanup that needs to happen, or they're going to be much more vulnerable to sea level rise. And so I think that as horrible as it's been to kind of witness, the way politics have turned, I think it's been a good awakening for how much there is a connection between these kinds of identity politics and these, you know, really infrastructure issues and scientific issues around environmental work.
Could I ask you all as well, Liz, about, since you mentioned it, what to do about low-income people? Because they're going to be affected disproportionately by climate change, and it brings in the whole question also about food production. Some...
Around what kind of people? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. About I want to actually go to Liz on this. Annalise, I'm sorry. I want to go to Liz on this first, okay. But then we'll hear from you. Talk about just the incompatibility of low-income people and all this to whatever changes we might have, because they're going to be hurt and the impact's going to be on them the most.
Right. So the people who are most impacted by the conditions now will be the ones who are most impacted by the conditions of
exactly.
the future.
Yeah.
And so I think, there's a definition of resiliency that talks about it not only being the acute shocks, but also the chronic stresses. And so if we think about what life is like for many of those who live on the lower end of the spectrum, it is that they are constantly facing those chronic stresses. So when it comes for the big one hitting, they don't have the capacity, not because they lack an ability, but because they've been facing all of these other things. And so in my work, one of the things that we try to do is look at, well, how do we actually address those chronic stresses? How do we actually, instead of patronizingly saying, hey, let's provide this housing for you, actually going and talking to the people who are most impacted and asking them, well, what do you need? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when I go in and have those conversations, what I hear is it's not just about getting a better shelter over their head. It's about the fact that they can barely make ends meet with the job that they have. And if they happen to get a better job, that means that whatever subsidy they might have been receiving to help them out, it goes down. Or maybe they weren't getting any subsidy, but now that they have a job where they're working more hours, how are they going to pay for daycare? How are they going to do all of these things? And so I think unless we're asking the question of how do we actually create systems to address that, we can't effectively prepare people to be able to deal with when the big one finally hits or when sea level rises.
You know,
I want to go, Alex, back to Annalise on this, because I was going to ask you about food production and all this. I mean, what we're doing with urban farming and what we're doing with the kinds of things that we're moving forward on that really provide more equity when it comes to eating and food production in general. Some thoughts in terms of the future here.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to how do we want to build our cities and how do we want to incorporate farms and food production into that. I think right now in the United States, we have a model where most of our food is imported from another place. Like, it's not, I mean, we have a whole local voir culture here in San Francisco, which is kind of boutique food that's grown locally. But most people get food that's trucked in or shipped in. And that's just the norm. And, you know, a lot of, arguments have been made that if we want to reduce our carbon footprint, one way we can do that is to try to have, it's not that you would be necessarily farming on your roof, although that's nice. It would really be having farms located near the city that would make the city or make a set of cities basically able to sustain themselves within a local region. And so you aren't depending on truck routes, for example, to get your tomatoes or to get your oranges or to get your grapes or whatever. And so I think that food production is a huge part of it. No city exists without farm, essentially. You can't have a city on its own without some way of producing food. And I mean, even Jane Jacobs talks about this. You know, she had this fantasy that we would have these totally self-sustaining cities. And I don't know if we can go completely there. Like, I don't think we're ever going to have a moment, at least in our lifetimes, where San Francisco is totally, everyone in the city is eating food only grown locally. That's a great goal, but I think that that's what we have to work toward.
I was working towards something here, too, because we're going to take this up to some extent in the next hour. But I think you wanted to weigh in here, Alex, quickly, and then we'll go to the audience.
What I wanted to say is that when we're talking especially about issues of equity and justice, one of the most important things to remember is that speed is justice. That the difference between, say, 1.5 degrees of warming and 2 degrees of warming is profound, right? Hundreds of millions more people put at risk, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The difference between 2 degrees and 3 degrees is even more profound. And if we're serious about looking out for everyone, the first thing we need to do is put as few people as possible in harm's way. And so when we're talking about acting, we're not just talking about an action that needs to be taken in a way that doesn't disadvantage people who have less. But we're also talking about acting quickly enough that we have intergenerational justice and intercommunity justice about how few impacts we can have, how little damage we can do. First, do no harm.
Do no harm, or do as little harm as you possibly can. Let me go to the audience, and we'll go begin with Bob in the audience. Join us.
Hi. The Capital Corridor rail line goes, as it goes around the bay, especially past Port Costa, is almost right at water level. And I was wondering, what are the first worst effects that you expect in the Bay Area from rising sea level?
I think we're going to defer here, if we may, to you, Richard Kennedy.
Yeah, so there are parts of the Capital Corridor that are immediately at risk. They're already showing signs of flooding when there's a king tide. The community of San Rafael, the community of East Palo Alto, parts of Hayward are already starting to overtop and flood. And so there is a tone in a lot of what folks are saying tonight around the urgency to act and move. And ultimately, we're going to have to make a decision about where to act first, because we have at 500 miles of edge at minimum in the Bay Area, and that's only the Bay Area.
Richard, excuse me, you have any inkling about that? What would the answer you provide even tentative to that, where to act first?
Where to act first would be where we have the most people and the most risk. So communities like East Palo Alto, like San Rafael, Hayward, and parts of Alameda, where people are in harm's way.
We're going to go to somebody else in the audience, but that's Jennifer. Jennifer, please join us.
Hi. So Alex is pointing out that we have to move fast, and Liz has pointed out that we can only change as fast as individuals want to change, and there's so many people in San Francisco who hold the power who don't want change. There's a really strong anti-growth sentiment. There's a lot of people who believe that sustainability means doing nothing, pulling up the drawbridge and not letting anybody else in. If we need to move fast, how do we change the common wisdom about growth in San Francisco?
Step up to the plate, whoever would like to.
Fight harder. This is the single most important fight that we face, is how do we change our region to not only reduce climate emissions, but also to protect ourselves against future impacts and to take care of people, to mitigate this housing crisis we have, to produce the kind of city we want to live in. And it is a conflictual fight. There are sides here. There are people who are benefiting from not acting, and there are people who are being hurt from the lack of action. And one side's going to win. And if we care about the future, we better make sure that the side that wants to do something wins.
Could I also just add to that?
Let's hear from you, Liz.
I think
this is Liz Ogbu.
The moving fast also has to go in parallel with asking the right questions and pushing on the right issues. I think part of what has happened in the past is that we've moved, but we've only ever dealt with the surface issue. And so part of what we've been talking about here is that unless we deal with the underlying issues, whether it's racism or the full-on climate change, we're not actually going to be able to make any difference. So if you are out there fighting, fight for the harder thing. Don't fight for the easy thing.
But I remember there was a writer, a friend of mine named Ted Rozak, who wrote an article years ago that appeared in the New York Times. It was from a book of his, and it was called Environmental Triage. I mean, where do you start and where do you begin? A lot of people are, I think I could maybe speak for many people in the audience here when I say sometimes it's overwhelming when you think of, should I start with forestry? Should we start with the water? Should we start with the air? Particularly in terms of carbon, that seems to obviously rise to the top, but setting up that triage is sometimes really extraordinarily challenging.
Yeah, and so I guess I think of it from two different lenses. One is this idea that some of it is we just have to, like, it is a scary thing, and we let our fear sometimes keep us from acting. And so there's a psychologist, Susan David, who said courage is not the absence of fear, but fear walking. So I think about things, all of you in this room and who are listening have probably done something that is you think is the hardest thing you have ever done in your life. And at some point, as you were trying to think of why to do it, there was probably something that kept you going, whether it was because you thought what was going to happen on the other side was going to be better, or the place that you were now is so impossible that you can't not move, or just that you just know deep within yourselves this is something you need to do. And somehow you figured out a way to do it, whether it was breaking down the problem into smaller discrete pieces to make that first step possible. Maybe it's just talking to that neighbor who is a total anti-climate change, anti-immigration, the whole long nine yards. Or maybe it's just finding a coalition of partners that you can work with so that you are not acting in this alone. I think all of us actually have the tools that we apply in other places of our lives to be able to solve hard things.
You're saying face your fear, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And talk to people.
And even if you feel helpless, which many of us do in the face of what we know about climate change, face the fear as best and as formidably as you can. Let's go to another member of our audience. It's Alex joining us. Alex, welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to pose the question. So three of the panelists, Liz, Alex, and Ali, have talked about these bold visions and how we need to kind of have radical leaps forward. And I feel like looking at the political shifts in organizing around the Green New Deal specifically, and how this is like a grassroots movement, how we can use this as an opportunity to have a just transition and have these discussions that we need to happen about how to radically change our agricultural system, how to decarbonize, how to be just and racially equitable. And this is kind of a good moment to have it, and it's a moment that wasn't there before. So with that in mind, Alex and Anna Lee, how do you feel that the arts can be used to galvanize people and really energize them to become involved? And also, how do you feel that the resiliency aspects that we really need to have in our building and built environment can be integrated in these types of proposals?
Thank you, Alex, for those questions. Annalie, we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the role that the arts can play in this. I mean, as a science fiction writer, one of the things I tackle in my work is climate change and cities of the future. And part of, you know, science fiction or futurism can work in two ways. It can be a warning, so you can write a dystopia where you show kind of the effects of climate change and what it means to live in a city where half the people are drowning and half the people are like, you know, living on the blood of young men and living for thousands of years or whatever. Not that I am subtweeting anyone there. Or you can write something that is about tackling these big questions and that imagines how you build new kinds of coalitions. I really think it's interesting that a lot of what we've said on the panel today has been about how do you connect groups together that haven't been connected before? How do you connect issues together that haven't been connected before? I find it super helpful to have a kind of imaginary roadmap in mind, whether it comes from science fiction or from a more fact-based futurism, like what Alex does. And I think part of that goes to the hope question. How do you maintain hope for the future? You know, it's by having these kinds of fantasies in your head of where we might end up. Are we gonna be living in ecotopia? Which I actually still, even though it was written in the early 70s, I think Ernest Kallenbach's classic Ecotopia, if you haven't read it, definitely check it out. It's about sort of imagining a sustainable future for California. I mean, there's also a terrible war, and like we have to have CalExit and a bunch of other stuff, which I think is sad. But, you know, so maybe not CalExit, but definitely the Ecotopia part is great. So it sustains us, but it also gives us a sense of like, what do we want to work toward? Like, who do we need to find as our allies and our friends? Who would have thought that, you know, architects and, you know, science fiction writer, you know, would team up and you know, create a better world? But I think that these are the kinds of coalitions that we need to form to tackle these questions. They have to be people coming from many different places and many different positions and knowledge bases. So
what an important and significant point you're making here. I mean, particularly in grassroots and populist movements and anything along those lines that can be galvanized. And I love the fact that you're promoting Ernie Kallenbach, who is probably one of our finest writers to come out of the Bay Area. But let me go to you on this, Alex. I'd like to hear more about how people can be moved maybe from you or what you think in terms of coalitions. You mentioned the Green Deal. Do you have some real optimism there?
I think the Green New Deal is a fight that we have to have at the federal level. I don't think it's going to be easy or come quick, but I think putting the level of federal ambition where it needs to be is really important. And I think especially...
Is this where people can go, though? I mean, do you see something actually
I think it's one of the things. I think, though, as well, that it's really important. What we were just hearing about in terms of imagination is really important. The climate crisis is, above all else, a crisis of imagination. That we don't imagine solving the problem, so we find it overwhelming, something that we can't defeat. We can't build what we can't imagine. And so if we want a zero carbon, just, economically prosperous, beautiful Bay Area, we have to start by imagining it.
Well, I'm back to actually a statement that you made. We've been emphasizing with you from the very beginning the necessity for speed here in a quote from you, delay is the fastest way to make climate exacerbate wealth inequality.
Absolutely.
Cannot delay. I mean, that's really the message here that we're all, I think, pretty much putting forward. Let's go back to our audience. The next question is from Ronnie. Ronnie, join us.
Hi. Thank you very much. In the last 10 years in San Francisco, density has increased, and so has traffic. So if you could address how we could give up our cars, that would be a step forward.
Well, Liz, you have a vision, I think, on this. Everybody's going to be driving electric cars or maybe being transported in different ways?
Yeah, it's the Jetsons.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can get there. I think, one of the things is that even though density has increased, we haven't necessarily changed our work systems, right? So the demand of the car is still happening because the systems of capital that make this city function are still requiring people to live way out there to be able to come back and be able to work. And so, again, it goes back to the whole we can't build our way out of it, that we have to do, it's building and, right, not an either or. And so I would say that some of the things we need to do to get to the carless society is actually thinking about how are we retrofitting the system of capital and the system of work and the system of living. Like, if we could actually get people to live close to where they work, we wouldn't have so many cars on the street, but we haven't actually been able to tackle that as an issue. And so I do think we could get to the place where we could reduce traffic, but we'd have to start looking at tackling these other problems that are part of what you're seeing out there on the street.
We used to talk about this as smart growth, and there was a whole plan to really get jobs, new kind of jobs that were really concentrated near where people lived and all that sort of thing. We made real progress. There's no denying that, but we have to make, again, speedy and greater progress, to put it mildly. We're going to go to Kaing now. Kaing, who's out in the audience there. Kaing, well, join us.
One of the panelists was saying earlier that the poorest people are affected by climate change the most, and I really agree with that. On the other hand, people who live in the city tend to make more compared to, on average, people who don't live in the cities, and we also tend to have a lower carbon footprint. We don't commute for as long. We take more public transportation. I don't know if it's really true, but probably there are more vegetarians in San Francisco than in the middle of Mississippi. And so how do we encourage more people to live in the city? And not only by building more in San Francisco, but like how do we have more cities in Mississippi, for example?
Well, we're talking again about spreading the word here. Some thoughts? I mean, sometimes this is really just good marketing, imaginative, getting the word out and spreading it as best you can in any way you can.
There are tens of millions of people who would like to be living in walkable neighborhoods who can't afford to right now.
Yeah.
So building more walkable neighborhoods would be a really good place to start.
Other thoughts from our science fiction writer here?
We have to build better neighborhoods. We have to build more housing. And I also do think that it comes back to what Liz was saying about reimagining how work works, basically where people work and how they live in relationship to their work. And so I think that's part of what we're going to have to think about as we build our cities for the future, is making sure that there's ways for people to survive in the city on an income that might not be comparable to somebody working at a tech company. And I think, as as we move forward, this may become more possible, but we also may be facing something darker.
Well, we're facing the end of this hour, unfortunately. I'm going to conclude with one single question. No, and this has been a very rich and, I think, important conversation, and I thank all the participants and thank those of you in the audience. But let's talk about the single thing you hope to do in the next decade, or you hope that people do and will be galvanized to do. And I'd like to begin, if I may, with you, Richard Kennedy.
Yeah, I'm going to continue.
Seconds left, by the way.
To make cities greener, more vibrant, more dynamic, more democratic, and work to make the public realm, the place that we all live and where the action of cities happens, as equitable, as beautiful, as resilient as possible, and hope to involve as many people and many communities in that work as much as we can.
And kudos to you for that commitment. Liz, can I go to you next?
Sure. So I believe that we need to start talking about how are we actually healing the social structures that are underpinning our cities. And so my work is going to be talking about how do we heal those structures at the same time as we're doing the building that we need to do to actually improve life for everyone, not just a select few.
And again, with seconds left, Alex Steffen?
Well, we have a new baby at home. And, you know, with hope, he'll see 2100. And I would love for all of us, when we're looking at these questions, to remember those kids, those grandkids. They are the future. Let's bring the future into rooms like these.
Final word from you, Annalie.
I think we really need to learn from history and not forget that we've been living in cities for thousands of years, and we have a lot of data about what helps cities survive for thousands of years and what makes people abandon them. And so let's not forget.
And let's leave it there. Thank you all for a terrific hour. Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Newman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.